Peace and love, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of In Defense of Liberation, the show that is working towards and educating about true people's liberation movements and revolution. I am your host, Raven. I use she, her pronouns. And I kind of wanted to hop on here today because I've been feeling like I think most of us are for quite some time now, this immense feeling of dread. Just, I don't know how to express it to people. I don't know how to get people who don't focus on and think about the same things that I do to really understand, but my heart is broken. Every single day. I'm miserable. Every single day. I try my best. I really do. To fight through it. To understand that through tragedy, through struggle, comes what we need. Comes a betterment of conditions. Comes sovereignty. Comes control over our destiny and our resources and our lives. As people. But at the same time, we're not there yet. And so every single day I go to work, every single day I have a day off, every single day I have to go run an errand, or every time I take a shower, every time I have a full-cooked, warm, filling meal. Every time I have a blanket on my lap, every time I lay down in bed, Gaza is there. And I'm not saying this, I really want to be clear here. I am not a good person. I'm not. We have failed. We have failed miserably, and we are failing miserably, but we still have to keep fighting. We can't just fail. We can't just give up. And that's what I'm really, you know, here to talk about and struggle through, because you can toxic positivity your way into psychosis. You can convince yourself that things are different than what they truly are. Look at those who support Israel today, who support the United States, who support the settler colonial institutions of occupation and oppression. Think about all the mythology that goes into sustaining these institutions, and how even as things begin to crumble and fall, even as people are more and more becoming convinced of the inhumanity and the illogical nature, at least from our perspective, of this system and the unimaginable idea that it could continue or that it should continue is becoming more and more decimated. But at the same time, the question still remains, what do we do? What do we do? I don't have the answer. If you're coming to this show for concrete answers, join an organization, form one, and come to conclusions about concrete problems within a collective, within an organization. Don't take my word for it. Don't take anybody's word for granted. Do your study. do your due diligence, but more importantly, outshine me and outshine others who continuously sit at home and press record. We are pathetic. We are a very pathetic people. That is, those of us who grew up and lived most of our lives within the imperialist core nations. And what's sad is even Europe is showing us up right now. The American people, specifically American white people, myself included, have an indoctrination and a lived experience that presents to us from childhood the idea that our own personal betterment and safety and security is more important than anything else, is more necessary than anything else. That shit lingers. That shit affects us. That shit comes out in moments where you don't expect. Like, you know, I lose empathy at certain points in the middle of my shift, you know? And I'm not the most fun person to talk to when I'm upset. And, you know, when I'm not doing well, I don't really want to be around anybody. I don't want to do anything. And, like, yeah, there's a part of us that probably wants to say, well, that's human, that's, you know, what it is. You need your time to figure your shit out, to rest, to heal, whatever. To what extent that is true, it is more true that the majority of people do not have those options, do not have the ability to check in with themselves, to engage in self-help, to go to therapy, to, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's ridiculous that a lot of us think that it's okay, or that it's more important for us each to get ourselves right before we worry about others. Because, yeah, it might make sense from one perspective. You can't help anybody if you can't help yourself. But who can really help themselves? Who really, independently, without the assistance of anybody, without anyone else's ideas, without anyone else's input or advice or encouragement or support, is able to really get themselves right, get their head right, get their situation right? Like, wealthy people, if even that. Because again, where's their wealth come from? Not them. So what I really want to say is that, again, you know, I've hit on this point a million times before, I'll say it again. Without collectivity, we are helpless. Without collective action, without organization, without communication, without relationships with one another, we're each out adrift to sea alone against the most advanced, most militarized, most developed, most financially equipped, wealthy, expansive, and exploitative empire that has ever existed. We are up against a historic system, a way of living, a way in which billions of people have been born, been raised, lived their lives, raised their children to live that way as well, and then have gone on to die without ever seeing a different system, without ever pushing back against that system. Billions of people have come and gone under capitalism and imperialism, and we cannot let this train keep chugging forward. We cannot allow for millions more to die in the Congo. We cannot allow for the 1.5 million in Rafah to die. We cannot allow for nations like China, Russia, and their people to suffer the consequences, the attacks, the assault from imperialist nations in the West. We cannot allow for Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Mexico, all of these different nations throughout the Americas to continuously be bullied and abused by the Monroe Doctrine, by exploitative corporations, by militaries, by immigration services, by intelligence agencies. We cannot allow this fate to be the fate of humanity any longer. Because as it stands right now, I think most of us around the world really are sensing a shift, a serious cataclysm between the very assumed way that each of us were about or going about living our lives to how we are living our lives today. Those of us who are trying to become conscious of what is happening, trying to organize, trying to improve ourselves, trying to do what we can. That cataclysm, that massive shift is also becoming evident on a larger scale. Not only because more people are, say, coming out as pro-Palestinian, which is just a human, innate conclusion to support and be behind people who are oppressed, who are suffering, who are struggling against an oppressive occupation. But also because as this genocide expands, as this full frontal extermination of a people, of Palestinians, men, women, children, elderly folks, the disabled, teachers, doctors, students, engineers. This is not just, you know, this is not an army against an army. This is not a military on a battlefield against another military on a battlefield. As the Qassam brigades and other brigades have released, you know, videos and information about, they are there in northern Gaza. They are there attacking military outposts, settlers, going after the IDF, the IOF, who are coming in and trying to build settlements, who are trying to clear land, who are destroying graveyards, who are destroying historical sites, who are destroying religious monuments, historical documents, etc. And they are there, that is, the resistance brigades, ready to engage in, you know, battle. They are engaging in battle. They are struggling for their liberation. While Israel, the state known as Israel, is in its headquarters, bombing from across the border, hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, destroying entire neighborhoods, entire city blocks, destroying entire apartment buildings, when we know that this state known as Israel maintains and holds weapons which have been used in the past to kill precisely one target. They have successfully bombed a building with other inhabitants in it and killed only an intended target. But this oftentimes happens on international land. This happens in a car bombing or in a sniping or a stabbing of a diplomat or an organizer or a resistance fighter's family member, whatever, whatever. They hold the tools to be able to, if they wanted to, actually try to specifically target militants. But
this is not their stated objective. Whether it's the head of the IDF, whether it's the Minister of Finance, whether it's the Minister of Culture, whether it's the Prime Minister himself, whether it's the far-right stooges, the extremist rabbis, which he subscribes to, which folks like Ben Gavir subscribe to, what they are speaking about, what they are stating clearly as an objective is a full extermination and removal of anything that could be considered Palestinian. This includes the land itself. We are seeing that they're bombing entire cities, not just to kill people, but to destroy every ounce of infrastructure, development, modernity, advancement, culture, religion. This is genocide, because as we know, genocide is not just the intent or act of harming in whole or part a specific people group, or killing them even, but it is also destroying their means to reproduce, destroying their means to develop culture, destroying their means to develop a political system, destroying their means to control their land and resources. All of these are a part of genocide. And if you don't have just outright extermination, you can still have genocide. And right now, we are seeing all of the above. But it's not just happening in Gaza, and we've spoken about this as well. Genocide is a historic phenomenon which ruling classes, specifically empires, who, as they are coming to rule and as they are on their way out, begin to advance and go to the extremes, really, of these ends of extermination, of assassination, of destruction of human life, of human existence, of human history. Let me just say this. When northern Gaza was initially beginning to be destroyed and basically everyone who was in the region was forced out, you know, back a few months ago, we saw reports that IDF soldiers and the bombings had destroyed the Ministry of Information, which held millions of documents containing photos, videos, journals, documents, deeds, maps, family trees, like birth certificates, passports, books, clothing, everything, Palestine's history, Gaza's history. They've bombed libraries. Now, if we know anything about the East, about Arabic-speaking nations, we know have held some of the most relevant, old, primary source documents, thousands, if not millions of manuscripts about science, math, astronomy, physiology, biology, chemistry, calculus. The East is where math, science, and all of the arts really came to blossom, and blossomed for thousands of years, blossomed in a society that maintained a level of tolerance that we in the West have never seen thousands of years ago. And we know that they house documents from these times. They have monuments. They have buildings from these times that now are gone to the world. I know a lot of you art buffs out there worry about the different museums and all the precious paintings of the European heroes we're supposed to know and love. Oh, what would happen if those were destroyed? The people of Palestine know. The people of Palestine know, but they are not the only ones.
If today,
what we were seeing was an army versus an army, we could call it a war. We could call it a conflict. And I actually had to edit a clip because without even thinking of it, I referred to it as the conflict. We need to scratch that. We need to write in clear, plain language, speak in clear, plain language about what is happening. This is a people whose children, at as young as 11 or 12, are deciding that they have no other hope, they have no other responsibility, they have no other opportunity but to resist. And this is beautiful in a way, seeing an entire people rise up, seeing folks resist, even amidst the darkest, most terrible times. But there's also something very sinister about a people's children having to fight for their lives just to live, just to see another day. I really want to talk about the contradictions that are rising also within Turtle Island. But it's difficult because, first of all, I'm not really on the ground like I would like. You know, like I'm doing what I can. I organize with Spirit of Mandela, with Black Alliance for Peace. We're trying to organize in the local area as well, some different groups out here. But other than that, you know, like most people, I have to work 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. And while I'm there, I can't, you know, talk to anybody. My coworkers have proven to be, in fact, not at all interested in any conversation other than just gossip about other coworkers, it seems. And also, you know, it's difficult because we, especially those who look from an objective point of view from the outside, or from a, whatever you call it, people who are looking from the bird's eye view, right? Seeing the photos, seeing the statements, seeing the videos, like, it's really, really, really easy to say, this isn't working. I mean, shit. We're 4 months into a genocide and folks are still trying to march. It's like, what are we accomplishing? Yeah, go have your march. Go put a couple thousand people in the direct sights of police and reactionaries and right-wingers who, hey, they don't got a problem with guns. They don't got a problem with violence. Go ahead and put all their faces on social media. Go ahead and put all your faces on social media. That seems like a good idea, right? I think right now what we have is a problem of ego. You have a lot of people, a lot of so-called leaders in the movement who think that they are thinking, as Kwame Ture would say, who think that they are thinking about things that they are not thinking about, who think they are thinking about things which they need to think about. We here on Turtle Island know that if we are honest with ourselves, we are settlers. We are settlers in an occupied territory which is not our own. This is the indigenous people's land. And the indigenous nations have resisted for centuries through all different means. There is a class society here. There are class divisions. A class analysis needs to be done, as Gerald Horn said on the Horn Report the other day. There are contradictions among oppressed people groups as well, between groups of oppressed people, but also within certain communities. Within oppressed people groups, you have class divisions as well. And we also have a serious lack of means of defense. Now, I can only talk about, you know, so much because, you know, but at the end of the day, the question becomes, are we able to not only succeed in our objectives, but to defend those victories from reaction, from repression? You're seeing a lot of people celebrate small victories. This person gets elected. This bill gets into Congress. This person goes on the news and says this. And we should be celebrating victories wherever they can be had. But we should not be seeing them in the light that we do. I think we are so hopeless we are willing to grasp onto anything and call it a victory. But where is the victory for the indigenous people of Turtle Island? Where are the victories for the First Nation people of so-called Canada? Where is the victory for the indigenous peoples of the Americas? Where is the victory? You see, we're putting our victories on a certain scale. We're measuring our victories by our perspectives. We have a march that shuts down a street for 6 hours. 30 of the main organizers are arrested. Each one of them has a bail set at $10,000 or more. They have to go through court dates. They have to travel. They have to get lawyers. They have to call for court support. Organizations have to give funds, have to give time, have to give resources to get these people out of prison, out of jail, out of the courts. And what happens? You see that people are scared. I'm scared. We are all scared to get arrested, to get detained, to get jumped, to get shot at, to do anything that might risk any small level of security that we have. You heard me earlier, you know, I'm pretty hesitant about talking about things at work now because I don't really have any support behind me anymore. But at the same time, what am I accepting here? What am I normalizing here? And what am I refusing to risk? A minimum wage job that I don't even like in the first place simply because it's secure? I've become comfortable in it. I've become used to it. Think about those of us who are going to school. What are we really studying for? What are we dedicating all our time and energy in this classroom to? Are we really receiving an education? Are we really being given an opportunity at something that we should be scrounging for? A higher income? A better pay, a title in front of our name. What are we fighting for here, people? What are we doing? We got organizations coming out with books in the middle of a genocide. What are we doing? I know it might sound backwards considering my constant and intentional commentary about the importance of study. But when you're watching an entire people be desecrated and you take money, time, resources, collectivity, power, whatever, and produce books instead of resistance, instead of organization. What you are saying to people is, you're too dumb to figure this out by yourself. And you're also not ready to actually join us and organize. So what we're going to do is we're going to write a book for you, you stupid idiot, that you can read, and then maybe you'll join my organization. That's another thing. If we are out here focused primarily on members, on people joining our organization, we have a lot coming for us. You know, most of these organizations are above ground, meaning that anyone can join these organizations. Based off of some research that has been done by some anarchists who have gone and infiltrated different right-wing groups or who have done surveillance on certain right-wing individuals, we've come to find out that many of these groups are also trying to do infiltration into left-wing groups, that many of the social democratic, liberal-type folks, right, who are running, who are leading a lot of these organizations under the auspices of so-called socialism, so-called Marxism, so-called communist ideology, right, they will accept and allow anyone into their collective, into their spaces, and give privileged information about other people's personal lives in a Zoom call to any new person who hops on. We in the movement, whatever you want to call it, in our organizations, need to become more serious about security. Mass organizations are different. But when we're talking about groups that call themselves socialists, that call themselves revolutionary, that are trying to, you know, develop organizers for the struggle, there are only, there should only be real, committed, already experienced, already proven, already vetted people in that organization. No one should be able to join these groups that can compromise principles, that can cause distraction, that can shift energy or shift objectives by their own individual actions or ignorance. And we also cannot be compromising on our long-term goals, on our long-term objectives, simply because every single person we come across isn't there yet. We need to develop collectives. We need to develop institutions. We need to develop means for not only just understanding reality as it is, having our own little book groups, you know, think tanks, basically, talking in an echo chamber with one another, but we also need to be developing activities and means to bring a new world into existence. And more importantly, to bring an old world, an old way of living, to its final end. I myself am someone who, if you've listened to my show, I've been all over the place politically, at least to the extent that even in the 3 years, 4 years that I've done the podcast, a lot of my stated ideology, a lot of my opinions have shifted over time. At one time, I would have called myself a Maoist. I don't even really know what that means anymore.
And, you know, at one time, there were certain things that I would have focused on that now it's like, how does that even matter? But something that has never changed is my understanding that without mass participation in something, that these organizations that exist that need to really play the example, the indigenous, the African, the Latino, the different organizations that are really in the forefront, on the front lines, taking the brunt of the hits, getting killed, getting put in prison, getting, you know, exiled, kicked out of their home country, even though, you know, they're supposedly going back to their home country. Many people have not lived, are not allowed to live, are not able to live in their real homes because of imperialism, because of capitalism, because the destruction that their nations and that their people have to suffer, like Palestine. These are the people who are willing to sacrifice, who are willing to struggle, who are willing to engage in a type of struggle that many of us are not even willing to think about, won't even talk about. We are seeing more and more that around the world, something that I've been told by the PSL, by DSA members, by CPUSA members, by basically every left, you know, mainstream group, is no longer viable. And that is armed struggle. We have to understand that around the world, armed struggle is a daily experience. This is a historical analysis, by the way. This is not a call to action. We do not support violence on this show, you know. You know how that goes. But this is a historical analysis, this is a material analysis to say that, again, it is not the oppressed people who decide to fight back in the beginning. It is the oppressed people who are first oppressed, who are first occupied, who are colonized, who are exploited, who have their homes destroyed, their lives destroyed, their culture destroyed, their religions co-opted, their politics co-opted, their leaders assassinated, their schools and hospitals and libraries bombed. And then some of them, not all of them still, but some of them say, I'm tired of this. If they are going to fire at me, then these folks say I will fire back, right? It is happening on every continent. There is some form of organized movement. There is some form of action being taken that really raises the contradictions. Because what we are seeing internationally, what we are seeing in the region, in West Asia, is an intensification, a heightening of contradictions. A heightening of contradictions also between the ruling classes. Because we are seeing that there are splits, even among the ruling class in the United States. There are splits between the ruling classes of different Arab regimes. There are splits between Europe and America. There are splits between Europe and Europe. And these are caused by an inability to hide behind similarities. Because in a calm, comforting environment, we can all say, oh, I'm for peace. I'm for peace. I'm for peace. I want a ceasefire. I want innocent lives to stop being harmed. But in the context of war, in the context of a situation where we don't get to just say, oh, I want an end to violence, because violence is the daily experience. It is no longer enough to simply be for peace as a general abstract idea. But now you really have to say what you mean and mean what you say. And we are seeing that ruling classes around the world are incapable of this. They lie. They cheat, they steal,
but they do the same to one another. They scam one another. They bribe one another. They exploit one another for political gains, for social gains, for economic gains. And then they abandon one another. They turn on each other in an election season or during a lawsuit when they give up names. The ruling class is not a tight-knit unit as we are meant to believe. They have shared interests. But we've all been in a room of people we got shared interests with. We know that at the end of the day, when we leave there, we're not all going home to do the same things in the same type of way because we all believe the same exact things. We are not going to all do the same things on, you know, based on what we believe, even if we believe in similar things. We will choose our own tactics. We will choose our own approach. We will choose our own ideas. And more importantly than anything, oftentimes, we will choose our own safety, our own protection over anything else. Like any living being, we will fight to protect ourselves, to survive. But again, I ask, what are we fighting for? Are we fighting for a few extra crumbs? For a sham mirage of a democracy? Are we fighting for rights that can be taken away in an instant? Are we fighting to free people from prisons who can be harassed or assassinated or put right back in those prisons on new trumped-up charges? What are we fighting for? What is our end goal? Because if we really want liberation, if we really want freedom, if we really want an end to capitalism, if we really want an end to innocent people's suffering, then we have to understand that there are real roles and real responsibilities we need to take up. They won't all look the same, but if we work as an organized, cohesive front, whether that's in a garden or as a party, when we act as a block, when we organize as a class of people, not only are our numbers our strength, but our experience, our lived experience, is our evidence, is our motivation. But our organization is our accountability. Our collective holds our principles in their minds. And when we do not live up to the principles we state we have, we must be in a space where we will be called out, where we will have to come correct, and where we will have to adjust. Again, I will say simply for the record, there have been marches of over 500,000, millions even before. There has been thousands of electoral campaigns, local and federal. There have been millions of bills, legislation, attempted to be passed. And there have been thousands of politicians who have been harassed at their office, at their home, and far worse. Y'all forget sometimes that people historically usually assassinate leaders that they don't support. We forget that we have had presidents assassinated before. We forget that there have been extremes that have been taken, and still, look at where we are. Look at where we are. What objectives have we been fighting for? What means have we chosen for our ends?
What ends do we even have in our mind? Are we willing to compromise with a better situation for ourselves while the rest of the world suffers? This is a question we each have to answer. I've been studying Islam. Nah, I should say, I'm reading the Quran and watching some YouTube videos. That's my study right now. But in studying Palestine, the history, and also understanding the population, the material conditions, and the resistance factions, like origins, where they come from, their principles, whatever, I've come to an understanding that, well, first of all, personally, for my own belief, that if I were to ever support, believe in, or be able to practice an organized religion, it would likely be Islam. And it's for a couple reasons. One, having grown up in the West, having grown up in the United States, having grown up as an evangelical Christian, I was taught that basically the world is full of sin. That because man, human beings, chose in the Garden of Eden to follow Satan's temptation, the God that created us has abandoned us. Has essentially condemned us to an earth which is full of temptation, suffering, corruption, death, everything that can be described. And that any one of us within that cannot gain paradise, cannot make it to heaven through our actions, through caring about one another, through taking care of one another. But it is only our faith in Jesus Christ and the resurrection and our asking for forgiveness that places us in his good graces, places us beside him in heaven. Now, to me, this never really made sense because, you know, the very easy question that probably some of our more anti-theist listeners would immediately bring up is like, well, what about X bad person, right? Like, in youth group, twice, I asked the question directly. If Adolf Hitler were to ask for forgiveness sincerely on his deathbed, would he be let into heaven? And both times the answer I was given was yes. If he really meant it, he would be let into heaven. Now, to me, this is immediately illogical. Because what's the point then? You know, the assumption that I think each young Christian kid comes to is that I don't really have to worry about anything I do ever. And I don't even really have to believe in God until, like, I die. That's the assumption I came to. I don't know if I'm just a little loopy, but like the conclusion I drew is that your actions on this earth don't matter. And so that to me really became a huge red flag. And it really became an evidence as to why Christianity is not a religion of the people, if it ever was anymore. And certainly is not a religion which I can believe in or support. And this is not to shit on individual Christians, Catholics, whatever. Like, y'all gotta sort your shit out. I'm not better than you because I'm not Christian. But I do think that it is important that each one of us, especially those of us who were raised indoctrinated, question the beliefs that we hold, whether or not they're true, whether or not they match up to reality, and whether or not they're just bullshit that we were taught by people that we were supposed to be able to trust. But Islam is very different. One of the first things that stuck out to me in reading the Quran is
Your actions on this earth most definitely are what you will be judged upon. And you can pray 5 times a day, every single day, and still, your actions, whether or not you give to the poor, whether you fight oppression, whether or not you stand up for justice and for humanity, will weigh more than just your devout faith in Allah. And at the end of the day, what I've really come to understand is that those who oppress, well, let me say it like this. Those who come to love life become infatuated with the things, the pleasantries, the comforts that oftentimes wealth, especially, allows you. The more opportunity they are given to exploit that. And in my understanding, you know, I see that as logical because effectively, these people are more and more, by taking advantage and exploiting people, of course, creating opportunities for themselves to be better, to live longer, to live better lives. To be better off, to live better lives, to live comfortably, to live longer, and to live in a way that really is dependent upon the suffering of thousands, if not billions. And they will be given those opportunities, of course, because they have exploited and made their way to a point where they can attain them. But also because they are being tempted to show their true character. When these fascistic, oppressive, exterminationist leaders of the state known as Israel go on live television and call Palestinians animals, call Palestinians terrorists, cut off their water, cut off their food, cut off their electricity. They are marking themselves. They are exposing themselves to the world. And some of the most incredible actions have come by means of simply exposing the reality at hand. When October 7th happened, it was clear from day one to people who were really in the know, paying attention, understood the history, that this was an attempt by an organization that had been able to unite and build collaboration, unity, organization between Muslim, Christian, non-practicing peoples, people coming from different backgrounds, coming from different class positions, people coming from different areas geographically, around the necessity to not get revenge, but to strategically put on display, first of all, that picture of the bulldozer knocking down the concentration camp wall. That picture alone was a historic moment that cannot be taken from the Palestinian people. They broke through, and they realized they can continue to do so. the second, there was, before October 7th, over 5,000 illegal detainees being held in prisoner of war camps, being brutalized, being tortured, at ages as young as 6 or 8 or 10, with no charges against them, under a title of what is called administrative detention. This is kidnapping. This is taking prisoners in a war of occupation and attrition. And the Palestinian organizations came to the conclusion that they needed a bargaining chip to get those prisoners free. And so they were able to seize some incredible amount of leadership within the IDF and IOF. Their families, they were able to take hostages that many have come out since their time or spoken during their time of being held by the different brigades in Palestine, that their treatment has been miraculous and eye-opening. You had an elderly woman who thanked and hugged her supposed captor, and thanked him. You had the mother of a young girl who wrote a thank you letter to Hamas, thanking them for teaching her daughter about them, about their culture, and about their religion, thanking them for instilling a sense of exercise and health into their daughter and encouraging her and being kind to her. You had the videos of young settlers shaking hands with and high-fiving different brigade members, different resistance fighters on their way home, released with no sense of physical mental harm, no fear, no... Because we're not stupid, right? People know how to read people. We saw the videos. We know what we're talking about. So when they talk, when they say their shit, when they say Hamas killed so-and-so, they burned a family, they did this. In the first instance, many of these cases have been proven untrue. And in the second instance, we also know that those who are telling these stories have been liars for centuries. So why would they tell the truth now? Because it's them that are being attacked, finally? And lastly, strategically speaking, this action led to the heightening of contradictions once again. And the reason why this is important is because now we are seeing around the world, there are very clearly two camps. There are those who support and stand with Palestine, and that is mainly the people of the world. And then there are governments around the world who are either actively or through avoidance complicit in the genocide happening today, who now are seen clearly for what they are. I have all love and support for the Chinese people. But my sincerest question to them today is where is your revolutionaries? Where are your freedom fighters? Where are your armies? You have the largest military of any, you know, non-European North American state. Where are the volunteer brigades from these so-called socialist nations? They might have socialism at home, in form, in embryo, in development. But without the willingness, as Cuba once did, as Nicaragua once did, as China once did, to send not just doctors, lawyers, engineers, but to send militants, to send militaries. Where is the willingness to fight? I don't have it. This is mainly because I don't really have that experience. But the oppressed people of the world do. The Haitian people are with Palestine. The Kenyan people are with Palestine. The people of Jamaica are with Palestine. The indigenous nations of the world are with Palestine. So where are we? What are we doing? What are we focused on? That is my question to you today. It's my question and self-critique to myself. What are we doing? And I know this is kind of a repetition of the last episode, so let me know if you'd rather have me talk about something else.
Peace.
We just want to round off with a couple of announcements. First of all, urgently, Mumia Abu-Jamal is facing health complications due to his psoriasis of the liver, his former bout with hepatitis C, and his recent bypass surgery due to a lack of proper nutrition. Well, first of all, I mean, let's be honest. Due to his incarceration, everything that comes with it, his lack of nutrition, his lack of exercise, his lack of socialization, his lack of proper medical care, that's all because he's currently in a concentration camp. And he has been taken as an example. He has been taken to show to the rest of us that, hey, this is what happens when you try to fight back. So watch out. But we got to stand with Mumia. And we also got to stand with Leonard Peltier. So before I move to that, please reach out to... Well, honestly, reach out to me. I'll put you in contact with who you need to be in contact with, all right? Second of all, Leonard Peltier. So two things. One, Leonard is... currently losing his vision very quickly. I myself take the opinion that Amilcar Cabral spoke about when it came to the assassination of Kwame Nkrumah, that is the cancer of corruption, the cancer of capitalism, the cancer of collaboration. Leonard Peltier is dying because he is captured, because he is a hostage. He is a detainee, but more than that, he's a prisoner of war. He is an oppressed person from an indigenous nation which is currently occupied, who happened to be a part of an organization which was trying to liberate its people by bringing education, resources, and other forms of materials and resistance to their people, who was accused of the killing of an FBI agent and who has sat in a prisoner of war camp, a concentration camp, ever since. So he's losing his vision, but also he just lost his sister. Leonard has been in prison for over 48 years, if I'm correct. He hasn't been able to hold his babies, his grandbabies, his great-grandbabies. But he also, once again, will not be able to say goodbye.
Mumia was not able to say goodbye to Wadia because he was locked down in this concentration camp. Now Leonard will not be able to say goodbye to his sister. These people must be freed. And we can talk about compassionate release, but as Sister Betty and Ralph Pointer talked about on their program for some time, as Ramona Africa and others who were on What's Happening the other night before me said, when has this occupation, when has this settler colonial state ever been compassionate, especially to the people it occupies and colonize? So, lastly, it is Kamal Siddiqui's 71st birthday tomorrow, or today, yes, today. And so, throughout this week, but also continuing forward, we, urge everybody to get in contact with the International Committee to Free Kamal Siddiqui, to reach out and to connect on his link tree to find ways to engage. They're hoping to raise $7,100, to have 71 organizations, small, local, units to form, and also that, in general, people just engage, get Kamal freed, right? And this is something that's really become very close to my heart in the last year. Political prisoners are our heroes, our freedom fighters, our revolutionaries, they're our leaders, they're our real forefathers, foremothers, forepeople. Like, they're who came before, who made every sacrifice. Many of them never able to have a family, never been able to hold a steady career, never able to just live life. For decades, not been able to breathe fresh air, eat fresh food, hold their family members. We have to take stock of ourselves and our so-called movement and ask, is really anything moving? You know, it is. I think it is. I hope it is. But we got a lot of ground to move on, and not a lot of time to move on it. So let's bump up that urgency. Let's see, any other announcements? Oh, the Uhuru 3, they are being brought to trial. So Omali Yeshitela and Penny Hess and Jesse Novelle, they are finally facing these trumped up charges in court. They're going to have their day in court. So please go to Hands Off Uhuru, Hands Off Africa. You can look up the Uhuru 3, or you can also look up the African People's Socialist Party. These organizations, specifically those of the oppressed people who speak clearly about not only the national context, but also the international context, those who do not just simply focus on, say, their own problems, but also understand and incorporate the connections between their problems and the problems of oppressed people around the world, are on the front lines being attacked right now. Members of different communist parties, socialist parties, movements, the shack dwellers movement, the Maoists in the Philippines, and they're under attack. There are groups everywhere who, whether we agree entirely with their ideology or not, are really putting their ideology, their principles into practice and struggling. And, you know, there's a level of respect there, because at the end of the day, I don't think most of us really ever do that. So let's fight, folks. Let's see, you know, what we can each do, how we can each engage. Let's stay connected. Let's stay engaging, and let's fight forward, move forward, and never stop. All power to the people. Free the land. Free all political prisoners. Free Palestine, and all power to the Palestinian people. All power to the resistance fighters. May Allah, may they be protected, may they be watched over, and if and when they may become martyrs, may they be accepted into paradise and also be an inspiration to those around them, those they come from, to abandon failed and misplaced hope in incorrect ideas.
Peace, y'all.